It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. How are your friendships doing? Earlier this fall, Pew Research Center released findings from a survey it did about Americans and their friendships. According to Pew, 61% of U.S. adults said having close friends is extremely important or very important for people to live a fulfilling life. That's more than 30% higher than the number of people who said being married or having kids or having lots of money was the key to fulfillment. But what happens when those friendships, even the close ones, start to run out of steam? Given that importance, it can be really hard to take a hard look at what we're getting and not getting from our friendly relationships. Our next guest has some suggestions to help. That includes making the call, in some cases, to break up with our friends. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How important are your friends in your life? How satisfied are you with your friendships? How often do you really reflect on your friendships, their value, whether they're healthy, and have you ever ended a friend relationship on purpose, or you just let it fizzle out? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Todd Kashdan is professor of psychology at George Mason University in Northern Virginia and an expert on the psychology of well-being, psychological strengths, mental agility, and social relationships. His books include The Upside of Your Dark Side and The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. He recently wrote a newsletter post about breaking up with friends. Todd, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, it's so good to be here.
You cover a lot of different social relationship topics in your work and on your newsletter. What led you to tackle our friendships this time around?
Well, one of the interesting things that happened during the pandemic was you had people trapped in their households and you saw this bifurcated response. People had realized how strong their romantic relationships, relationships with their kids and friendships are. And other people realized they aren't as strong as intimate as they thought. And they felt lonely, even though they had people with them trapped in their house for years.
And how did that end up affecting the importance we place on friends?
I think it made people realize, one, fitting with the science, that there is no greater predictor of who ends up very happy versus just being happy than the quality and significance of our relationships. But in over the past few years, I think people realize that I'm investing a ton in my romance life. I'm investing a ton if I have kids, but very little rituals exist in society other than this thing called Friendsgiving for what we do with our friends.
Yeah, I think a lot of us might think, you know, friendships just happen naturally. They emerge out of whatever proximity, shared interest, and they rise or fall on their own power. Is it worth thinking about them as something we might have to do some work on, just like we might work on a marriage or other romantic relationship?
Absolutely. And that's why I'm glad we're having this conversation. Because if we really dissect what are the things that we get from friends that are a little bit timeless compared to other relationships, and you can break it down into six. So one is good friends are there when you need support. The other is when you need help, like you don't know how to break open a lawnmower when it's broken or fix a flat tire. The other is loyalty, is that they're going to stand for you even when you're not there and protect your reputation. Then there's a sense of trust. You can confide in them. Don't forget, you just have these joyful, pleasant, funny, wacky, bizarre experiences. And finally, someone to share in not just the bad things that happen in your life, but share your successes without feeling envious or jealous. And that's six really juicy things to have in your life.
You talk about kind of an experiment of doing friendship audits, taking these relationships that we might take for granted and thinking about what kind of value we get from them, which could lead us to appreciate them all the more or to figure out if we need to fix or end things. How do we get started on that process? We think of this friendship in a way we haven't thought of it before.
Yeah, so I just made a cute little survey based on the scientific research. And one of the things you could ask yourself is, after you spend time with them, is your energy going up, going down, or staying the same regularly? And so you can make this is a really good indicator of the quality of being with the person. There's some people, if you play pickleball or basketball or chess, like, do you find yourself annoyed and disturbed after interacting with them, because that's usually a sign that this is not someone that is fitting well into your life, unless they have some super specialized skill or strength that they're giving you. Another one is, to what degree, when after you share something important to them, do you feel heard and validated? Are they your cheerleader, or do they treat you like an inanimate object, like those cheese balls that we always pass in Costco, but you never really want to be buying them? And then another one is, how do you resolve conflicts in your friendship? And if you're not having any conflicts, you can ask, are we talking about the things that really matter to me in life? Like the things that really are pushing my boundaries and pissing me off so much that I feel compelled to write something on social media.
This is Wisconsin. We might buy that cheese ball. I want to make that clear, Todd. We're talking to Todd Kashdan, professor of psychology at George Mason University in Northern Virginia. We are talking about friendships, putting more value on them, auditing them, seeing if they're doing what we want in our lives, and maybe, if that's what it takes, ending them. You could join in with your friendship stories, good, bad, otherwise, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chloe is with us in La Crosse. Chloe, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
I just wanted to say I think it's really cool that you guys are doing this segment, and I've had friends that I've kept since second grade, and it's been some of the most valuable time for me in my life, and those friends that I've had the longest, I also have a ton of conflict with, because I'm a person who doesn't shy away from conflict, and I'm, you know, we've had breakups, and a lot of times we've come back together, and our relationship's been even stronger, and I think it's the same as a romantic relationship. You have to stick up for what's right for you, and sometimes you push someone away for a bit, but with those friendships, sometimes they get stronger because of it.
Interesting, Chloe. Thanks so much for sharing that. Well, Todd, let's talk about that. When is it time to think about a friendship breakup, or in Chloe's case, a friendship break for a while?
Yeah, I just want to say, I'm so glad Chloe was the first call, because she's such a role model for thinking about friendship seriously, which is that you can break up and you can get back together again. And part of this is, and here's like a mantra that I tend to have as a psychologist, which is, other than your old friends, like Chloe's talking about having those people that have known her at different stages of her life since second grade, if you have no change in your friendships every 10 years, you can ask yourself, am I even growing or evolving a lot? Like, you should be outgrowing a few of your friendships. And one of the things is to have sometimes those difficult conversations with yourself first, is, do I feel as if I am being the person I most like to be when I'm around these characters?
Chloe, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Now, Todd, one option is, you know, sometimes friendships just slowly fizzle and nobody really notices it, and then they're just gone. But you give examples in your own life and that of others where there's a conversation about the end of a friendship. That sounds horrible to me. How, if we're in that situation where we want to talk about dissolving the friendship, how do we have that conversation?
Yeah, I'm glad you felt the, you know, that clamminess inside, because you should feel that. And if you don't, it probably the relationship doesn't mean anything. I mean, one of the most important strategies is what I call the discomfort caveat. And this is also useful if you want to get a raise at work and have that conversation with your boss, which is, start the conversation by describing how hard the conversation is for you and why. And so you might want to go to someone and say, listen, I love hanging out with you. We've been friends ever since our kids started playing with each other in kindergarten. But sometimes, and I feel even anxious saying this to you, I feel as if I am such a low priority in your life that you would, if the ice cream man came down the block, you would cancel plans that we set for months to go see a concert to make sure that you were in line with your kids to go get some cones. And it feels as if it's so unimportant to you and I feel differently. Like, maybe we should just kind of have a conversation about that. And by you revealing that you feel anxious about it up front, what that does is it brings people's defenses down and they feel compassion and empathy as opposed to trying to rip your head off.
And you've been through conversations like this. You wrote about some of them. I mean, how bad was it? I get clabby just thinking about it. How did it come out?
Yeah, they're cringy, you know, but they make great stories. And I'm really proud of myself that I actually did it, because you really, you know, you just want to like take your head into another whiskey and say, I'll just wait until this thing, they fade out and stop calling me. You know, one of the scenarios that I talk about is when I was in my 30s and I had a friend who was super intelligent, like entrepreneur. And every time he hung out, he would tell me about his new ventures, how much money he's making. I mean, would list the actual details of all the amazing things that he bought. And I was just barely surviving paycheck to paycheck to pay for my townhouse. And I realized after several months that he never asked me any questions ever. And while I enjoy hearing about it, and I love his successes, it's really important is it reciprocated? And all of us have this experience of, hey, did that person ask you any questions over that 3-hour dinner? And you're always like, no. So we must be that person sometimes to other people. And I think if we are just candid enough to say, hey, I just want to say, I know this is uncomfortable to say, I realized you didn't ask me one thing over that entire 3-hour time we're having a barbecue. And we're standing right next to each other. Like, did you even notice that? And they'll probably say no. And they'll probably appreciate the feedback, even though you might get some shock and awe in the beginning.
We're talking about friendships with Todd Kashdan, professor of psychology at George Mason University. Talk about how to evaluate, to mend, and if necessary, end those relationships. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have an experience you'd like to share, a question for our guest, have you ever consciously and actively decided to end a friendship with someone? Or flip it around, did you ever find an old friendship that you realized had fizzled and rekindled it? You reached out and sparked it all over again. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with social relationships expert Todd Kashdan, professor of psychology at George Mason University, talking about the state of friendships around the country and maybe your own friendships and how and when to decide to end them. If need be, you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Edward called us from Illinois. Couldn't stay on the line, but Edward says he had friends he made related to substance abuse. But when lives change in that regard, he says it's hard to remain connected. Todd, a situation where maintaining those connections, as much as you may have appreciated at the time, may endanger your recovery. This is a pretty important thing to think about.
Yeah, and I'm, again, another role model, which is, to what degree am I in a relationship with someone that's improving my mental health or leading to a deterioration in my mental health? And this happens a lot with men as well, where often when you're first dating and you're younger and you're in your 20s and you're taking more risks, is you develop these friendships where you gain social status and likability by how many boundaries you break. And when you get older and you have a more stable life, and maybe you found a person, maybe you formed a family, those relationships often become, for lack of a better word, too immature for our current value system. And that's often a very challenging divide, because you like the 20-something person you are when you're around them, but you know that's not really who you are at the present time. And we have to honor that as we change, we might need to change our relationships. And sometimes it just means spending less time with those people that we knew in our younger years.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Pam is with us now in Marshall. Pam, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I just wanted to talk. Well, I had a friend many years ago. I'm 73, and this was when I was about 30. And she wanted me to help her. She had some money she needed to be borrowed to, and I didn't have a lot, but whatever, I helped her. And then she wanted me to babysit free for it at night so she could go out. And I was working full-time and a single parent also, but I did. Problem was, in those days, I didn't know how to say no until I got to the point that I got furious. So I finally got furious and told her I wasn't going to have her in my life again. And then about 20 years ago, and I had moved and everything, somehow she got a hold of me by phone, left me a message to please call her. She really, really wanted to talk. She couldn't wait to hear me again. I called her, and she wanted to know if she could borrow $20. I broke up with her again.
Pam, wow. I'm sorry about that, but thanks for sharing that, Todd. Yeah, we want to help our friends. We want to be there for them. Where do we cross the line into, as our caller was, of being taken advantage of?
You know, it's funny. I have three daughters, and two are twin 16-year-olds, and I regularly tell them when they talk about problems with their friends or anyone they're dating, of like, hey, what's the ratio of stress to joy? And when the ratio is really problematic, really high numbers, where really stressful, like I don't even, like I'm doing favors, but I don't even feel good about them, like Pam is describing. And like, where's the joy that's counteracting that? If you can't get those numbers to balance out, like it does, the math does the work for you, and you realize, do I have other people that can replace them, that could increase the quality of my life?
Thanks again for sharing that story. We heard from Allie in Appleton, who couldn't stay on, but has a question about how to maintain friendship if you have a friend who keeps emotionally dumping problems onto you. So this is kind of related, I feel like, Todd. Like, if it's always a one-way street and they can dump their problems on you and you can go, when you're having trouble, talk it to them, that's one thing. If it's a one-way street, maybe something different?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a psychologist. I try to pretend I'm not one when I'm on airplanes and when I'm traveling, just because of this reason. Because as soon as I say it, I hear about everyone's divorces and all that, how horrible their kids are. I usually say, like, I'm an etymologist, or I'm a book editor. One of the important things for men in particular, because they're worse at this than women, is to signal the alarm and test it before a fire starts. And that is, low stakes, difficult experiences, throw them out there and see if your friends will ask questions, ask for details, take curiosity of what you're going to say. Because that tells you, before the big stuff happens, like, do they care and are they invested in my well-being? And if it's okay for asymmetry to happen here and there, where people are unloading on you every once in a while, it's never going to be equal in the moment, mm-hmm. but span the timeline over months and years. But you have to give a little bit of self-blame if you're not disclosing important things yourself that are difficult.
Talking to Todd Kashdan from George Mason University. Even though he tries to hide it, he is a psychologist and he writes about social relationships online very frequently. Still time for your experiences at 800-642-1234. Todd, I see every now and then there'll be a wave of articles on, you know, adults maybe don't have enough friends these days and adults don't know how to make friends, because it's not like we're five and we can walk up to somebody and say, will you be my friend? Or I don't know, can we?
Yeah.
How do we build new friendships?
You know, there's a great series of studies from the University of Chicago, and they ask people before they go on to public trains, metros, what do you think it'll be like for the person, a stranger, if you went up and had a conversation with them? And they say, oh my God, it'd be terrible. I'd be in their personal space. They'd probably spit on me. Like, they'd probably like videotape me and start cursing me out. And then they ask people to actually do it. Go talk to a stranger. Like, ask them about like what they're wearing. Like, what's the article that they're reading? And what you find is people underestimate how enjoyable it is for someone to come up to them and talk to them who's a stranger. And people underestimate how pleasurable it is have a conversation with a stranger. So everyone is making an erroneous expectation of what it's like to talk to someone. And because of that, you have all these people, more often men than women, that are sitting right next to each other and don't say a word because everyone thinks the other person would be particularly uncomfortable if a conversation was to be triggered.
Now, here's another question. You know, we've been talking about how we can evaluate if, you know, we have a bad friendship or the other person has turned into a bad friend. How can we self-diagnose and ask the question, am I the bad friend? Like, I know how I'm a bad friend. I'm terrible if we live in different cities. I'm terrible about keeping up with people. I know this. I've taken some steps on that. How do we self-evaluate to make sure we're being good friends to our friends?
It's a really good question. I mean, obviously the easier answer is you could ask someone, but you're not going to really get probably an honest response. When I ask people for their evaluation of me as a friend, as a colleague, I always open with a caveat of like, listen, I want you to start with the negative things. There's something that I have to suck at. Like, I am not the master of being a friend. So start with that. Tell me what I could do better. And then from there, you're not talking about, am I a good friend or not? They're just giving you, like, very playfully, you're having a jovial conversation of, what are you an 8 at or a 7 at, as opposed to a 10? And what they bring up is going to be like, you know, it's like the secret sauce of how bad it really is. Like, are they bringing up something that's minuscule? Like, you know, when I go on the grill, you never come and talk to me. You just, like, run around the party as if, like, I don't even exist. Or are they saying, you know what? I kind of feel like you're always flirting with my wife all the time. So those are two very different responses.
And how do we, just very briefly, Todd, I would be worried about, I would instantly lapse into defensive mode no matter how much I brace myself. How do we turn down those shields a little bit?
Yeah, so I think the answer is roll with the waves that happen there. So you are going to be defensive. You might be upset and say, whoa, that's a lot coming at me. I can't believe you waited this long to tell me. All right, I'm going to grab a drink. I'm going to come right back and just, like, let's just, like, put a cap and actually have this conversation now. And I will try my best not to blow my lid. So bringing, like, a little bit of playfulness into a serious conversation just to, like, allow it to take place. And then a few days later, you could have the more important details, nuanced conversation about what actually happened there and what you, now that you can think about it, what you really want to say.
Todd, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
That's Todd Kashdan, professor of psychology at George Mason University. We talked to him about evaluating our friendships, some of the best ways to fix them or end them if and when they've run their course for one reason or another. Keep sharing your stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Across the country, dogs have been reported as having symptoms of respiratory illnesses, similar to what's known as kennel cough, but in many cases more severe and longer lasting. It's not clear yet if this is a new illness or a bad run of more familiar diseases. If you're a dog owner, you might have seen the headlines and thought, should I be worried? Our next guest researches how infectious diseases spread in dogs and other animals. She has advice for how to protect your dog from getting sick. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard about what might be a new illness going around among dogs? Has your own dog come down with a respiratory illness this year? Do you have questions about prevention? And veterinarians love to hear what you are seeing out there. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Jessica Pritchard is a clinical assistant professor of small animal internal medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Jessica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Before we dig into the particulars, I'm kind of trying to figure out the right tone here. It looks like, you know, this is something serious, so worth investigating more, but not cause for panic at this point for dog owners. Does that feel about right?
Yes, absolutely. I think that learning more about this and being cautious is a good first step for pet owners right now.
So what kind of reports are we getting from veterinarians around the country that might look a little different from what we'd see ordinarily at this time of the year?
Yeah, so what we're hearing about is that there are some dogs that are coming down with a cough, and that's not atypical for this time of the year for dogs. They get what you've described accurately as kennel cough, which is really a blanket term for a variety of bacterial and viral infections that can cause dogs to cough. Most dogs that get infected with one or more of these agents cough for a while, they feel bad, but they recover. Some dogs have always, unfortunately, been sick enough that they have passed away from this kind of spectrum of disease. What we're getting reports of now is that some dogs seem to be staying sicker and coughing longer. And it seems like some dogs are manifesting with the more severe form of this illness in terms of having actual pneumonia rather than just coughing.
how closely do we as a nation keep track of respiratory illnesses among dogs? Are we kind of relying on anecdotes? Is there some kind of monitoring system like there might be for some human diseases?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, we are kind of relying on anecdotes here. And that's one of the difficult things, is that there's not a clear case definition for these dogs. Dogs cough for many, many reasons, everything from actual infectious disease to heart disease to chronic inflammatory lung diseases, similar to bronchitis in humans. So all of those things can lead dogs to be really sick. Dogs can be really sick from heart disease, and they can die from heart disease. They can be really sick from infectious diseases, and they can die from those too. So it's hard to know which of these dogs has which manifestation of this disease without a national reporting system, which we just don't have in place.
So what kind of things do we do to try to figure out, okay, is this a new illness or maybe a new mutation of an older illness, or it's just kind of a statistically bad luck kind of year where the more severe but common ailments are hitting dogs in higher numbers?
Yeah, I think we have to kind of look at the data that we have so far, and that when we are evaluating things that have changed in the last few years. We went from COVID, where lots of people were isolating. And so our dogs do what we do, and they were isolating with us. It meant that also a lot of people were home alone, and so they adopted dogs. Pet ownership soared during the pandemic. So we now have more dogs around. We have dogs that maybe didn't get normal veterinary care because they were always home with their owners. And a lot of the vaccines for things that cause kennel cough, like Bordetella vaccines, parainfluenza vaccines, influenza vaccines, are given yearly. So we had disrupted veterinary care during the pandemic. It was hard to get our pets in, and it's still hard to get our pets into the veterinarian. And then now we're not isolating anymore, which is great. We can go back out and do the things we love with our dogs. So is this dog's being exposed again when they're underprotected for these common agents, and we've kind of lost some of that herd immunity that we might have had before? Or is it truly something new? And there are state diagnostic labs across the country that are collecting samples from dogs and trying to find out if this is a new pathogen. The issue with that is that we have such great tools now to really dig deep into the lungs and into the respiratory tract and say, wow, what are all the microbial agents that we can find here? And some of them just naturally live there, and we just haven't found them before because science hadn't advanced that far. So finding something new doesn't necessarily mean it's pathologic. It could just be something that we haven't found before and not the cause of what we're seeing.
Have you seen any data or at least heard any anecdotes from veterinarians here in Wisconsin? Are they seeing some of the kinds of cases that other people are reporting elsewhere in the country?
To my knowledge, we have not had an outbreak of cases in Wisconsin. I have talked to vets sporadically across the state because we do a lot of consulting at the School of Vet Med with our local veterinary community. And there have been some vets who have reported having even some of their own dogs that have coughed and seemed sicker than they typically would expect with your kind of run-of-the-mill exposure to kennel cough.
Talking to Jessica Pritchard, Clinical Assistant Professor of Small Animal Internal Medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about some of the headlines you may have seen, maybe been concerned about if you're a dog owner, of what appear to be more severe than normal respiratory illnesses for dogs this time of year. Do you have questions and experience to share, thoughts or questions about precautions for dogs and their people? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jessica, I want to talk about the kinds of things that dog owners can do if they're concerned. First of all, you mentioned the common vaccines for dogs, and they may have been disrupted over the last few years. What kind of things should people be making sure that their dogs are up to date on?
Yeah, so there are some certain core vaccines that every dog should get. And one of those is distemper, which is a respiratory tract illness. So definitely making sure that your dog is up to date on their core vaccinations. But then those lifestyle vaccines, so those are things like Bordetella, parainfluenza, and canine influenza. Those are optional vaccines that are given yearly rather than every 3 years. So call and check in with your veterinarian if you're not sure if your dog is up to date. And especially if your dog is going to have exposure to other dogs, boosting their immunity by getting those vaccines is a great idea to do now.
And then when it comes to letting dogs mix and mingle with other dogs, it sounds like we're not at a point where we're saying, hey, keep dogs away from each other. Are there points like if dogs are showing symptoms, though, where we might say, okay, no play dates this week?
Yeah, I think one of the advantages that we have facing this as pet owners is that we've done this for ourselves with COVID. So we know what to do when there's something infectious going around. We're all really well trained, and we just have to apply those same principles to our dog. So if your dog seems at all ill or not like themselves, they shouldn't be around other dogs. So no dog parks, no dog daycare, avoiding social doggy situations like dog training classes or dog shows. Definitely signs to watch for would be, you know, weakness. If they're not eating and they're normally a really good eater, if they have difficulty breathing, which would be a fairly obvious sign, but breathing kind of faster and harder, even if they're just kind of sitting around in the living room or on the couch with us, and a cough that's present at all, don't take them around other dogs. If that cough gets significantly worse or is influencing their quality of life, call to check in with your vet.
What kind of treatments are there if the dog is in that situation, that cough doesn't go away, seems to get worse, pneumonial, weakness? Are there things that we can do to help the dog?
Yeah, absolutely. So we don't, similar to kind of the human cold, some of those are viral, some are bacterial. We often won't know what's afflicting the dog, if it's a viral cause to their cough or a bacterial cause. If we see evidence of pneumonia on x-rays of their chest, they'll often get antibiotics. But for a dog that's just coughing, but still eating and doing okay, antibiotics probably aren't indicated and they'll be able to get better on their own. But the dogs that are sick will sometimes need to be hospitalized. They will sometimes need some support in the form of oxygen or intravenous fluids and antibiotics given through an IV and then orally when they feel better.
We're talking to Dr. Jessica Pritchard, Clinical Assistant Professor of Small Animal Internal Medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, talking about respiratory illnesses for dogs, reports in some communities of worse than usual respiratory illness. Something new, something old, and acting a little different, still trying to figure that out. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen these reports? Do you have concerns or questions about what's out there? Will you be boarding your pet over the holidays, or do they attend some kind of doggy daycare? Are you worried about them getting sick? What kind of precautions do you see there? Join in at 800-642-1234. Anybody who works in the veterinary profession out there, love to hear if things are looking normal where you are or you have seen some unusual signs. Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dr. Jessica Pritchard, Clinical Assistant Professor of Small Animal Internal Medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, talking about how to protect our pets from the threat of a potentially new respiratory illness that's been reported in dogs around the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are the warning signs for you? You can tell when your own dog is feeling off, maybe sick. What kind of things show up when you decide to take them to the vet? Do you get them vaccinated for diseases? What questions do you have about how to keep your dog healthy? And what questions do you have about what this illness could potentially be? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Kay is with us in Berlin. Kay, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just have a comment. I have weighs 10 now. A mastiff, and earlier this year in the spring, he developed this awful cough, and he would cough so hard it was almost like he was trying to throw up. He was gagging so much on it. I gave it a week to see if it was something that would clear up. Took him to the vet. She didn't know exactly what was going on. He wasn't running a fever. He doesn't get around other animals, other dogs. And I'm always up to date on all of his vaccinations. So we took him and got a CAT scan done of his lungs and his chest and his heart. And it really didn't show anything. Everything looked pretty clear. So they put him on a prophylactic round of antibiotics just in case it might have been a really bad case of bronchitis. And it took him almost 3 months to get over this cough. It was awful.
Okay, thanks a lot. I'm glad it ended up, I'm sorry it took so long, but I'm glad it ended up working out for the best. Thanks for sharing that. Jessica, I think dogs are like people in that way. A lot of different things can cause a cough, and it can take a lot to tease out what's causing any given cough.
Absolutely, and it's hard. You know, we have to rely on what we see and what we report as dog owners to our veterinarians, since they can't tell us, you know, hey, it feels like this, or it's worse when I do this. It's based on our reporting of how the dogs are feeling and then crossing those things off the list until we find what the cause is.
Okay, thanks a lot for that call. We've got Eli on the line in Burlington. Eli, hi.
Hi.
Or is that L? I'm sorry, I misread that last L. L, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I have a greyhound who has an intestinal worm that is hard to treat from Florida. And I'm wondering if she's more susceptible to this really bad kennel cough that's going around.
Oh, thanks a lot for the call. Jessica, could having some other condition, in this case, worms, make a dog more susceptible to other illnesses like kennel cough or whatever is going around now?
Yeah, those worms in greyhounds from Florida are really difficult to treat and get rid of. There are thoughts that dogs that are immunocompromised, so either they're sick from another disease or if they are undergoing chemotherapy or getting immunomodulatory drugs otherwise, might be at a higher risk for disease. So I think probably with dogs like that, it's safest to try and minimize their contact with other dogs right now and make sure that they're up to date on all of their vaccines.
Thanks for that call, Elle. And Jessica, it sounds like this is a known problem in the veterinary world, worms and greyhounds from Florida. What's going on?
It is. So there are dogs in Florida that, specifically greyhounds, that have a type of intestinal worm that is harder than what we typically see to eradicate and take some pretty repeated courses or different drugs than we would often use. We're fortunate in Wisconsin that we don't have enough homeless dogs, so we import them from other states, which means as a veterinarian interested in infectious disease, I see a lot of diseases from all over the country that are not just geographically limited to Wisconsin.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. Hope that works out. Ruth is with us now in Eau Claire. Ruth, hi.
Yeah, our dog, who is 3.5, otherwise extremely your dog, right? He's an extremely healthy dog, but I had put him in daycare for a couple days a week, not knowing that this cough was going around. And then I heard about it going around, but by then he was showing symptoms of the cough. And within an hour and a half, he was coughing so hard he was coughing up blood. And took him in and got him in treatment like immediately with antibiotics and steroid, which helped, but it didn't eradicate the cough. The vet's being very aggressive with this. After his first round of antibiotics and steroid, he started coughing again. And so we took him in. He got 2 days of injections of antibiotics and steroid, and then back on the regular round of antibiotics and steroid. So it's definitely, when I talked to the vets, and we once took him into urgent care, and the urgent care vet said this issue is very much in our area, probably has been here for 2 months, if not longer. And they have lost otherwise healthy dogs, but mostly they're not losing them. The other thing we did, because of a recommendation by some very wise dog people, canine people, we put him on Manuka honey, he was up on Tuesday morning. He exhibited a cough again, even though he's on all these meds. Mm-hmm. And I have been giving him the Manuka honey now for 3 times a day and the cough is subsided. Like I might hear a little bit of a huff, but no deep cough is coming from him.
Ruth, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Sorry you're going through that. But a couple things there, Jessica. First of all, I mean, antibiotics, we'll try that. We don't know if this particular version of kennel cough is caused by a virus or a bacteria. If it's a virus, an antibiotic won't do much except maybe prevent a secondary bacterial infection. How much are we reaching for antibiotics when dogs exhibit these symptoms?
You're exactly right. So we try and make sure to limit inappropriate use of antibiotics and creating resistance to just be good stewards. And so we'll often look for signs of pneumonia on x-rays of the chest first. Things like a fever, a cough that's getting worse will make us feel like we should reach for antibiotics in those dogs. So a dog that just, you know, if an owner called and said, hey, my dog is coughing, but they're otherwise doing okay at home, my advice would be, you know, watch them closely. As long as they're breathing fine, they're eating, drinking, doing their normal dog things, and coughing is not interfering with their otherwise quality of life, just keep watching them. But it's the dogs that stop eating. Like Ruth said, you know, her dog was very, very sick, coughing up blood and really unwell. Those are the dogs that we are worried that even if they started with the virus, they've got a secondary bacterial infection now and need some antibiotics to help get them over the hump.
And she also mentioned, you know, the vets saying they've seen a lot of this. Given that we don't, as you're saying earlier, we don't have a standard monitoring system, if veterinarians all of a sudden feel like, yeah, this is weird, we're seeing these unusual symptoms, like, who should they tell about that? Who should they raise at least a yellow flag to say, hey, something's out of ordinary here?
Yeah, the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab is accepting samples that they're doing some extra testing on. So I would say, if vets, you know, call in and let the WVDL know that they think they're seeing this, they can get instructions on what samples to submit and how to submit them, that we can test and see, you know, are we seeing this same thing in Wisconsin that they're seeing in the Northeast or in Oregon or in Canada right now? But it's hard to get that sort of coordination because also we, you know, people don't necessarily have insurance for their pets and they're, you know, someone has to pay for the testing that we do, which kind of puts owners in a difficult situation sometimes too.
Carl also mentioned using a particular kind of honey as a remedy. Now, I know there are probably, just like for people, a lot of alternative treatments out there. How can people make sure that they're doing something that is at least neutral, that an alternative treatment might not do more harm than good?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think talking with their veterinarian and making sure that there's no contraindication to their pet receiving that supplement or, you know, extra treatment that they've heard about through friends is a great idea. For most dogs, honey in small quantities is perfectly fine. But if you had a diabetic dog, for instance, that could really throw off their regulation.
We also had a question from Bob in Madison who wonders if there are pneumonia vaccines for dogs like there are for humans.
Yeah, great question. Right now, we don't have an analogous pneumonia vaccine in dogs. We just have kind of our core distemper vaccine and then Bordetella, parainfluenza, and influenza, although the influenza vaccine has been on back order in various places. So that one's a little difficult to get right now.
Thanks for the question, Bob. Jessica, just very briefly, what are you watching for next as we try to understand what's going on?
Yeah, I am really looking for, you know, veterinarians, I think, as a community, even though we lack kind of a central reporting mechanism, are very good at coordinating care and talking about what we're seeing. So I think, you know, watching for the state diagnostic labs across the country and up in Canada as well to see what they find from these dogs. And, you know, is it truly that we're seeing more dogs that are sicker, or have we, you know, not seen outbreaks of kennel cough in so many years? And so this seems like something new because we've been busy with other things for 3 years. So I think we'll learn a lot more as we keep talking about it. I think as pet owners, and I have two dogs myself, just remembering to be cautious, but not panic right now.
Jessica, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jessica Pritchard is a clinical assistant professor of small animal internal medicine at UW's School of Veterinary Medicine. She talks to us about respiratory illnesses among dogs, reports of the spread of worse than usual ones, and precautions we can take to keep pets safe. If you're looking to boost your memory, there might be an answer in Japanese food. As reported by CBS News, researchers in Japan did a double-blind study of wasabi. That's a green paste, has kind of a unique spiciness, like horseradish sauce. In the study, people took wasabi capsules and a control group didn't. After a few months of that, the wasabi group did better on verbal memory tests, face and name tests, and more. That's just one study, of course. More research to be done. I have a very distinct wasabi memory. One time I was eating Japanese food, dipped a bit of a roll into soy sauce with wasabi in it. When it hit my tongue, I felt the texture of a big glob of wasabi, and I knew I was doomed for the next 5-10 minutes. A couple seconds in, I felt the taste, then the famous whoosh through the sinuses, but a really concentrated dose of whoosh. Just thinking about that moment, I can almost feel it again. So maybe there is something to wasabi as a memory cure. But oh yeah, bad news. CBS reports that a lot of times that wasabi on the table at your restaurant, it's actually just horseradish sauce dyed green. Whoosh, there it is. This is Central Time.